You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7am to 8:30am.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are on Thursday morning breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Good morning, Leela.
Good morning, Priya.
How are you doing this morning?
Well, I am not feeling super fresh. There's a couple of reasons for that, but the most exciting one is I found out you can look at the moon through binoculars, folk.
You can do that.
And
it's perfectly
legal. I
stayed
awake for quite a while doing that because I actually had a clear view of the moon from my bed.
Take advantage of a clear view of the moon. That's our advice to you for this week.
Yes, yes. The holiday season.
Well, I was thinking, you know, what do I get the young folks in my family when I see them at the end of this year? And binoculars was on the list of things under consideration. Now I'm like, you know what? Maybe they do need binoculars. You can do so much with those things.
You really can. You know, you could even, if you really wanted to, look at your phone really super magnified, you know.
Would you get somebody to hold it far away?
Yeah, maybe.
And then look at it? I mean, I think binoculars is probably a safer bet than getting my cousin's two little kids walkie-talkies, because I think that may be a recipe for disaster for the parents. But also it sounds like so much fun. Yeah. I wish someone had bought me walkie-talkies to use with my siblings
I was a kid. We would have started collectivizing, resisting and communicating a lot earlier, I think.
Exactly, which means that we wouldn't be speaking to you because we would have already been cracked down on by the state. So we have a big and quite serious show for you today. So, you know, last week was the second week of our 16 days of activism against gender-based violence coverage. But we did also want to remind listeners that this issue is 365 days a year and that we need to think about a structural analysis and systemic and sustained action past branded initiatives that really take into account the deep roots of gender-based violence and, you know, intersectional violences that amplify the gendered experiences, particularly of First Nations women and children in so-called Australia. And so first up today, we are going to actually have an international conversation that touches on these concerns. And we're going to hear the first part of a two-part interview with Genevieve Kaninda, who's the Brussels-based policy and advocacy officer at the African Futures Lab, on the Brussels Court of Appeal's landmark decision earlier this month to recognize the Belgian state's responsibility in abducting and racially segregating biracial Métis children under its colonial rule of what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so this is a conversation that will really echo stolen generation experiences here, these techniques of violence against particularly women and children and families that is reproduced over and over again across colonial states. So it's a really important conversation, and I think we'll link into our next topic.
Yeah, and as you said, Priya, the violence continues after 16 days, and we will continue to cover these topics because they are so central to justice for all of us. So we will have Sherelle Moody after that, who joins us to discuss mapping femicide in so-called Australia, media coverage of gender-based violence, and the impact of gendered violence on First Nations women and children. Sherelle has over 20 years of experience reporting across a range of areas for some of Australia's major media companies, And Sherelle is also the founder and operator of the Red Heart Campaign and has been documenting the killing of women and children since 2015.
Yeah, and I think it'll be really, really vital to have the opportunity to discuss particularly how the structural nature of gender-based violence is upheld with Sherelle, who has such such a long track record of experience in the media and interfacing with state actors via her advocacy role. And after that, we're going to hear part two of a talk given by Palestinian scholar and theorist Abdeljawad Omar during the early October 2024 Teach-In, The Left's Problem with Palestine, which is co-convened by the City University of New York for Palestine and Grad Center for Palestine. And we played part one last week. And a reminder that in this talk, Omar's been presenting a critical analysis of the Western left's reflexive condemnation of Palestinian resistance, both in relation to October 7th, 2023, and more broadly, and then the implications of this disavowal for the possibility of the West's own genuine engagement with anti-colonial struggle.
And finally, we're going to hear from NAM-based artists Grace Jubick and Dan Elbin, who join us to talk about the upcoming debut exhibition of works by Grace's own son, Elijah Kosei, a collection of sculptural works produced in collaboration with Dan and titled Hands.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to have Grace and Dan in the studio this morning. Elijah couldn't join us. He's got other plans for this morning, but for his debut exhibition, it's also going to be held on his birthday. Grace is holding, is cooking up a feast. It's going to be opening Sunday, the 15th of December, 12 to 3 p.m. at Art House Gallery on Warrandyari Country. That's 20 Old Warrandyte Road in Donvale. And yeah, I'm really, really keen to hear from Grace and Dan about Elijah's process, and also Grace about the experience of being an artist, a really well-established artist herself, and seeing her child grow into their own creative practice too.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
So you're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:07 in the morning.
Solidarity Breakfast, your Saturday morning serving of union and working news, current events, opinion and talkback. Every Saturday, 7:30 till 9 a.m. here on 3CR, 855 on your AM dial.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 12th of December. Public housing residents are back in court this week, fighting for accountability and transparency around the proposed demolition of 44 public housing towers in Naam. The class action movement against the Victorian government was stalled when Homes Victoria withheld key documents that led to the state government's decision to demolish the towers on the grounds it would harm public interest. Lawyers with Inner Melbourne Community Legal argued that Homes Victoria should release the documents, saying residents have a right to know how a decision to demolish their homes was made. Yesterday's hearing was about the public interest immunity of the documents, which needs to be resolved before the class action trial can commence.
Also in headlines, the National Tertiary Education Union is calling for the national adoption of the Fair Work Ombudsman's anti-wage theft model after revelations that the University of Melbourne was found to have underpaid more than 25,000 staff by $72 million. As part of an enforceable undertaking, Melbourne University is required to repay the owed wages and install regulation measures, including increased compliance oversight and establishing a worker voice mechanism to address future wage and entitlement concerns. The NTEU this week confirmed that national university wage theft amounts to almost $250 million in underpayments.
In other news this week, the National Children's Commissioner has urged the federal government to reaffirm its commitment to children's human rights as Queensland prepares to pass the controversial Making Queensland Safer Bill, which experts argue is disproportionately impacts vulnerable and First Nations children. The legislation introduced by the new Liberal Crisafulli government will mean children as young as 10 face life sentences. The bill removes the principle of detention as a last resort, raising concerns among human rights advocates that existing injustices in the juvenile justice system will worsen. The Commissioner described the bill as a, quote, international embarrassment, end quote, saying it contravenes so-called Australia's obligations under the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child.
Also in headlines, local residents in Narms West yesterday gathered to protest at Tarnate train station, demanding improved bus services in response to inadequate public transport options amongst rapidly increasing housing development. Members of the Better Buses campaign are frustrated by the lack of commitment from local ministers and are petitioning for more frequent and reliable bus services to alleviate traffic congestion and ensure equitable access for the fast-growing community in Melbourne's West. The protesters say forced car dependency is a huge issue for many residents, with the excessive costs of car ownership placing a financial burden on families who are already struggling to pay their rent during a cost-of-living crisis.
In other news, an independent investigation into Rio Tinto's former Panguna mine in Bougainville has confirmed ongoing environmental and human rights damage, including life-threatening risks from collapsing mine infrastructure and contamination of local rivers. The two-year study found widespread impacts on people's access to clean water, their ability to safely grow food and access to healthcare, and identified toxic chemicals in the environment. Despite this, Rio Tinto has not committed to addressing the report's findings, prompting local leaders to call for immediate remediation and an independently managed fund for long-term rehabilitation. The investigation, which was triggered by a complaint to the Human Rights Law Centre based in Naarm, validates what communities in Bougainville have been saying for decades, that the Panguna mine has left them living with an ongoing environmental and human rights disaster.
And finally, in more news about toxic mining companies, and with a warning that this headline contains mention of sexual assault allegations. Former employees have filed a landmark class action against mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP, alleging widespread sexual harassment and gender discrimination at their work sites over the past two decades. The claims include shocking incidents such as groping, explicit videos, and verbal abuse, with some women reporting retaliation after they raised complaints. Lawyers expect thousands of other workers to join the lawsuit as Rio Tinto and BHP face growing pressure to address toxic work cultures. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 12th of December, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
Hi! I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
In our first segment for today, we're going to hear part one of an interview with Genevieve Kaninda, Brussels-based policy and advocacy officer at the African Futures Lab, on the Brussels Court of Appeal's landmark decision earlier this month to recognize the Belgian state's responsibility in abducting and racially segregating biracial Métis children under its colonial rule of what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The DRC was subjected to brutal colonization by Belgium from 1908 until it gained independence in 1960, and the struggle for justice and reparations by Métis children of Congolese mothers and Belgian fathers has been waged across several decades both in Belgium and in the Great Lakes countries of the DRC, Burundi, and Rwanda. The African Futures Lab is an independent research and advocacy institute that aims to raise global awareness of racial injustice across Africa and Europe and to empower civil society actors and public and private entities to demand justice and achieve reform. This interview will cover distressing topics including forcible child removal, racism, and sexual violence. And if you want to skip this interview and our following conversation with Sherelle Moody about femicide in Australia, which will cover some similar topics, you can tune out for the next 30 minutes or until our next segment at 7:45 a.m. But if you do need to speak with someone for support, you can call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732, Lifeline on 131114, the Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners can also call 13-YARN, that's 139276, and Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. Genevieve, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for the interview.
Yeah, so I think just to get into this topic, I wanted to start by asking about the term Métis and the origins and the contested application of this term in the Congolese context, as well as the significance of this term in the struggle for reparations that we're going to be talking about. So can you tell us about the meaning of Métis in the context of Belgium's colonial racial administration?
Yeah, sure. So the original term was, in fact, and I'm going to say it in French because I'm not quite sure to have the equivalent in English, but I'm going to say it in French. The original term was mulâtre. And mulâtre, you can translate it to mule or mulet. It's like a cross between a donkey and a mare. And it's like, first, it's like animals, obviously. But moreover, it's like on a biological, I would say, meaning, it's like an anomaly. And that's how these children were considered like an anomaly, because they were, the fruit coming from a relation, but we don't use the term relation. I will go back to this after. A black mom and a white father. So that was the first word that were used to describe these children. And during their, struggle to gain recognition and reparations, but also apologies, the term, gradually used was Métis, because obviously the term mulatte was very offensive, and the children themselves, from what we heard and, received as explanations, preferred to use the term Métis, which is like a less offensive word for a person born from, a black, parent and a white parent.
And so my understanding of the use of the term is it's still, it's contested. Some people claim it in this struggle and other people want to distance themselves from it. But for an international audience, it's signifying, I guess, like a biracial identity that has emerged out of this this colonial regime and the effects, that it's had on this particular group of people.
Yes, exactly. The term mulatte was, a term that everyone wanted to, to not use because it was way too offensive. But I think that Métis was about also, about the dual identity of these children, because in their struggle, you can really feel that these identities, African and also European, is really at the core of the struggle, because first, they were told that, they were children, of sin, of shame. But also there was also an idea that that was put into their heads that because they had like white blood, they were like a little bit better than black people, but not better than white people. So you can see and you can feel when you talk with the Métis children from the colonization, that's the question of the dual identity is really, present. So I think that's why the term Métis is like the word that has gained the more consensus, to be used by the Métis children from colonization.
Yeah, and as you've said, the two identities and the struggle that is around not being allowed to be Congolese, but also not being considered Belgian either, has, it led within the Belgian colonial system of governance for the particular treatment and removal of children who, you know, were Métis. So in April 2024, the African Futures Lab published your report, 70 Years of Fighting for Justice and Reparations, Mobilizations by Métis People from the Great Lakes Abducted by the Belgian Colonial Administration. And this report covers the struggle for justice by Métis people in a transnational context. And so this is across the countries of the Great Lakes region. So that includes the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda, but also in Belgium itself. So to give us a bit of background about this, how have Métis people sought justice and reparations from the Belgian state? And can you tell us about some of the most significant aspects of this struggle over time?
So I think it's important to give like a bit of historical context here. So Belgium, in its three former colonies, so DR Congo, Burundi, and Rwanda, segregated the Métis children. And we had like two groups. The majority of them was abandoned in the Great Lakes region after the independence, and some of them were taken forcibly to Belgium and placed into orphanages and, you know, religious institutions. So these two groups, are the Métis children from the colonization in the context of the Belgian colonial administration. And the struggles actually... I would say started here in Belgium, I would say in a political sense, because I am quite sure that on the ground in the, you know, the Great Lakes, Métis children were also fighting. But I would say that the fight that led to the recognition and the apologies started here in Belgium. So we had these children taken forcibly to Belgium. They grew up here in Belgium, and they asked themselves questions of how they happened to be here, why are there, you know, orphans, and what happens, you know, for them to arrive in Belgium, knowing that they were born in Africa, DRC, Burundi, and Congo. And basically, what's happened is that these Métis children, but that became adult at the time, gathered together. And first, it was about, you know, just meeting together to acknowledge the fact that, oh, we lived the same thing. We actually have the same story. We don't come from the same places, but we share the same stories of being taken away of our, you know, African mothers and being placed to institutions, being taken to Belgium. And after this recognition of having the same story, it was about, okay, so what happened, and who is like the person responsible of what we have endured as children? And that's how the struggle is, started here in Belgium. So I think it was like several struggles that were, you know, being led at the same time. It was at the cultural level, because some of them like produced movies about, you know, the stories of the Métis children. Some of them tried to contact like museums to have, you know, access to archives, and saying, okay, maybe we should have like a conference or something talking about, you know, the fate of the Métis children. And I think that gradually that struggles about that was led on different levels, whether it's like cultural, political, etc., led to the recognition by the federal parliament of, you know, the fate of Métis children in 2018 and 19, and also the vote of a resolution. So that was the first time, and that was like a big step. But over time, and that's what the report is about, is that we see that there is like some missing points in the politics that the Belgian state is like, leading for the moment regarding the Métis children. The first one is that Belgium is like very focused on the Métis children that were taken to Belgium. And so you can see that there is like politics regarding, you know, their access to the nationality, the access to their birth certificate, which is great. But what about the great majority of the Métis that were abandoned in the Great Lakes region. And that's why we are, you know, working with these associations on the ground, like with the transnational coalition, but also with, you know, Métis children here in Belgium that are supporting the struggle of the Métis of the Great Lakes region, because they are totally concerned by the resolution and the apologies of the Belgian state. But, you know, on a concrete manner, nothing is like being done by the Belgian state, you know, to help them gaining reparations, you know, access to nationality, access to care, because as you can see, these stories also, you know, have a lot of suffering inside of them. And it's like they like medical support, whether it's like physically, but also, you know, mentally, obviously, and they are being left out by the Belgian state. And another missing point, which is very important for African Futures Lab, is the fate of the mothers. The first thing that we point out is that when you look closely at the women, and I would say like in bracket, women and the mothers, you can see that at the time, actually, they were children. So there is like a whole vision of the African girls and women at the time as, you know, colonial subject that is being left out. You can see, for example, in the ruling of the Court of Appeal of Brussels, that they have the age of the mothers of, I think, three or four of the five women. And you can see the age gap between these girls and the fathers of these women. So, for example, you have one mother that was maybe 15 or 14, and the father of one of the Métis women was like 58. And so there is like that kind of violences that was directed at the mothers of these children that are like, that were colonial subject, that is being left out in the way we analyze, you know, the violences of the colonial system. So you obviously have the suffering of the children because they were, you know, taken away from their families, from their mothers, and they were segregated. But you also have the violences that was before the children directed at the mothers, you know. So I think that this is like two very important points that we wanted to really showcase in this report.
Yeah, and it'll be a familiar and heartbreaking story for Australian listeners as well, considering, you know, the Stolen Generation here and the abduction of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, you know, from around the continent, and placement in religious institutions, placement on missions, you know, all of these colonial administrative rules that took people who were biracial away from their communities, disconnected them from their connection to culture, you know, alienated them without providing, you know, without providing a justification, and doing this on the basis of governing a population based on racialized blood quantum. It's really appalling to think about this. And then, as you mentioned, on top of that, we're not even talking about the, you know, the phenomenon of sexual violence in the colonial regime against these, you know, children, many of whom were, yeah, many of these women who ended up, you know, being the mothers of these children were children themselves. And so it is really, you know, the scale of violence is hard to comprehend. And it's hard to think about what is an adequate reparation that can actually be made to people that are that have been affected by this. And you're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was the first part of an interview with Genevieve Kaninda, Brussels-based Policy and Advocacy Officer at the African Futures Lab. And we were talking about the Brussels Court of Appeal's landmark decision earlier this month to recognize the Belgian state's responsibility in abducting and racially segregating biracial Métis children under its colonial rule of what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Again, this interview did cover some distressing topics, including forcible child removal, racism, and sexual violence. And if you did need to speak with somebody for support, remember, you can always call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. You can call Lifeline on 131114. The Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners can also call 13YARN. That's 139276. And Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563.
The next conversation on Thursday Breakfast will cover some distressing topics, such as sexual and gender-based violence, violence against First Nations women and children, and racism. Please be warned, this conversation may refer to Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who have died. If you want to skip this next interview, you can tune out for the next 15 minutes or until after the interview is finished at 7:45 a.m. And I will do a quick repeat of those support lines. If you need support before or after the show today, you can call 24-hour hotlines, including 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732, Lifeline 131114, Suicide Callback Service 1-300-659-467, and for mob-only support, you can call 13YARN on 139276 or Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. If you're between 18 and 25, you can also call Kids Helpline on 1-800-55-1800. Now, I'd like to welcome Sherelle Moody, who joins us to discuss mapping femicide in so-called Australia, media coverage of gender-based violence, and the impact of gendered violence on First Nations women and children, and the systemic factors that influence this. Sherelle has over 20 years of experience reporting across a range of areas for some of Australia's major media companies. Sherelle is also the founder and operator of the Red Heart Campaign and has been documenting the killing of women and children since 2015. Good morning, Sherelle.
Hi, thanks. Sorry, I'm getting an echo on my phone. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, that's fine. We can't hear it on our side. It actually should go away in a couple of minutes, so hopefully it's not too distracting. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. We've got a lot to cover today.
Sure.
And first of all, I wanted to ask you, what prompted you to begin specifically focusing on gendered violence and femicide in so-called Australia? And what kind of work do you do at the moment?
Yeah, so look, my work really just stems back to a couple of factors. One was when I was reporting on domestic violence quite a few years ago, I was getting a lot of kickback from editors who just didn't want to give space to the stories that I was bringing to them because, you know, they felt that readers were saturated and not interested in the topic of women experiencing violence. So I set up the Red Heart Campaign, and I decided to document the killing of women and children specifically as a response to my stepfather murdering two young girls, you know, so the documenting the memorial to women and children lost to violence, the femicide map, all of that really goes back to Stacey Ann Tracy and Sandra Dorothy Bacon, and it is done in their name. And I guess in a way it's a way of me repaying their families and society for what he took away.
Yeah, thank you for that background. I can see you have a personal connection to this topic that, yeah, does affect so many of us in
absolutely
so many personal ways.
Look, I think that if you're a woman and, you know, you really need, you've got skin in the game. We've been fighting gendered violence for all of our lives and for all of our grandmothers' lives and great-grandmothers' lives, it, you know, since man and women first appeared on Earth, and it really hasn't changed a lot in that time. It's just that, you know, now we're able to amplify the message a lot more effectively.
Mm. Yeah, it's well and truly a public interest topic that needs to be discussed in media. Now, you did mention that you've spent quite a length of time working in mainstream newsrooms. Yeah. What patterns have you identified in the way that gendered violence is reported on, and what do you think needs to change in that media space?
Look, I've been a journalist for 28 years and I actually stepped away in April, and one of the reasons was because I couldn't justify taking a wage or, you know, benefiting economically for a system that oppresses minority, disadvantaged and diverse community members. And one of the ways that that happens is the erasure of women from stories about their own deaths and also the othering of women. So basically media outlets refusing to name the victims in headlines when the names are available, or turning them into things like, you know, sort of addressing a woman by the kind of thing that might be associated with her death. For example, Frances Crawford's alleged murder. In the wake of her death and murder charge, she was constantly referred to as the mower murder because her body was found under a mower. And also in her case, you know, they constantly referred to her alleged killer as the, you know, the pilot and her as the wife, when in fact she was, well, she was Frances Crawford to start with, but she was also a psychologist. She was a very much loved community member. She was a person, but she was othered and she was thinged and she was erased. And that's just something that the media has done for as long as I've been a part of it, and for very much before that.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you've recently stepped away from journalism, and you're the founder and operator of the Red Heart Campaign, which is a campaign that features a femicide map documenting the deaths of women and children. What I wanted to know was, what difficulties have you encountered covering the deaths and documenting the deaths of specifically First Nations women and children? And can you tell us a bit of that background context?
Look, I think the biggest barrier for First Nations women and children who are lost to violence, for their families, for their community members, and not obviously not just me, because I'm just one very small part of the puzzle. But the biggest issue is the policing response is most often not adequate. In fact, it's often inadequate when women and children are at risk. But then there's also the erasure of them. So there's police not investigating their deaths or disappearances appropriately. And then when there is a killing, we may not ever hear about it. Like, you know, we hear about some of the deaths, but I have no doubt that there are many other women in particular who are killed or deliberately disappeared, and we're not knowing about them. And, you know, perhaps that's because a lot of First Nations women live in regional or remote areas, and the policing there is lackluster, and there's just a disregard for Indigenous women. It could be because of policy. For instance, Western Australia Police Force has a policy or a reluctance to actually tell us when women are killed. It is, you know, I will find out about a woman being killed in Western Australia 6 months after she's been killed. And basically police are just not even giving a basic media alert saying, hey, you know, this person has been lost and this person has been charged. So, yeah, I think there's a big web of silence from authorities, and that's a huge barrier, and it makes it impossible for anyone working in this sector who wants to improve lives if we don't have access to the correct numbers of people being killed.
Yeah. Now, moving on a bit from the documentation, there is a significant lack of political will, a widespread lack of political will when it comes to addressing femicide in Australia, and especially when it comes to addressing intersectional violences. Could you expand some more on the systemic factors that perpetuate femicide in Australia, and how the actions of state actors, including the police and the criminal legal system, factor into that?
Look, it's a significantly complex problem across many, many areas. One of the things that is a very common and potentially the most easy thing to fix is the holes in the safety net. So we know that governments do put an amount of money each year into services, anti-violence programs, all that sort of thing. So we know that there is a funding pool there, for sure. And we know that that funding does go to some services and some support providers and some perpetrator prevention programs. The problem is that a lot of these services don't meet the needs of diverse and marginalised communities. For example, in the situation with Aboriginal women, often a woman who is Indigenous, who is experiencing violence, has nowhere to go. And the reason they have nowhere to go is because they live on country. They don't want to leave country. They don't want to leave their community behind. In order to be housed safely, they have to leave. They have to go to another location. So basically, we are saying to these women, either you stay there and potentially die, or you uproot your life, you leave the things that are most valuable and important to you spiritually, physically and emotionally, to live in a community that you don't know, surrounded by people you don't know, most likely living in a house of predominantly white workers and, you know, predominantly white other survivors. So do you see what I mean? Like, if we don't have the proper resources to house women, Indigenous women in crisis within their own communities,
yeah,
then they're kind of stuck. You know, they're sort of, there is nowhere to go, and they shouldn't be forced to leave. You know, they shouldn't be forced to leave the thing that is most important to them. So that's just one. So that's like one hole in the safety net. And then you have holes where women with disability are not catered, for example, in refuge. So, for instance, someone in a wheelchair, there may not be a ramp. You will have people from smaller ethnic groups. So if you get a person, say, from the Lebanese community in Melbourne, when you call 000, you're a Lebanese speaker, you don't have much English. So 000 gets a translator on the line. Now, there's a really high likelihood that that translator knows you, knows your family, or knows someone in your community.
Yeah.
You hear their voice. How are you going to disclose that you're experiencing family violence to this person? It's a huge problem. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, there are just all of these holes, and no one seems to have the will to fix them. No one seems to have the will to recognise them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think
that's a really long answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot to cover. I'm sure you could have listed a lot more things there.
Yeah.
That's really just scratching the surface. But I think my main takeaway from that was that people experiencing gender-based violence should have the autonomy to decide what safety looks like for them, and they should be
Absolutely.
Supported to access
yeah,
it in the
sure.
ways that suit them. And that's not the case at the moment.
I think that a really, really important situation has occurred yesterday, and we can see this from the situation. So Khulod Hawat is the mum of five who was allegedly murdered in Sydney yesterday. Now, this is a woman whose partner was on an AVO. So he was actually known police, and that's a very common piece of knowledge that is out there at the moment, right? So he was on the police radar as a high-risk domestic violence offender. There was an AVO in place. This woman did what she was supposed to do, but she's also in the country alone. So only her children and her husband are her family here. The rest of her family lives overseas, so she's got limited support. At the press conference yesterday, the police officer overseeing the investigation in her death implied that she was to blame for her own murder by saying, domestic violence victims are not coming forward and telling us about what's happening. This woman literally did tell them the alleged perpetrator was under the police watch. You know, it's kind of like the police are saying, we can't do anything because the women are not telling us, but women are actually telling them. And often they're turned away. Often they're told, come back and tell us when it gets physical. Often, you know, there's all of this stuff. And it's just like one of the myriad of problems that women face when they are leaving violence or facing violence or just, you know, when they just want to live in peace.
Yeah. Yeah, that comment does sound suspiciously like a deflection of responsibility that ends up blaming the victims.
It is an absolute. Yeah. It is an absolute deflection. It is an implication. It's basically saying she didn't do the right thing. If she had done the right thing, she'd be alive, is what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And what woman is, after reading that, is going to go, oh, yeah, I'm going to tell the police right now about this when this is the response?
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. And thank you so much for sharing this insight into the work you do today, Sherelle. And our last question, do you have any messages that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we finish up?
Yeah, look, the only thing that I would say is on Saturday at 4 p.m. at Darling Gardens in Clifton Hill, there will be a vigil for the 16 Victorian women lost to violence in 2024. Now, the vigil will include honouring of people like Isla Bell, Sandra DiBillo, Charlize Hayter. There are 16 women who have lost their lives this year who are Victorian. We haven't actually had a vigil at all in Victoria for these women, and we're coming to the end of the year, and I think it's a really good time for the community to come together and just, you know, just come, hold space for them, meet some of their loved ones and just, you know, listen to a few words and just kind of let the people who love them know that we care as a community. So it would be awesome if people could make that.
Yeah, thank you, Sherelle. We'll put the details for that in our show notes if people want to go down and pay respect and mourn for those women lost to gender-based violence this year.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for speaking to us, and I hope you have a good morning.
No worries. Thanks, Leila. Take care. Bye.
That was a conversation with Sherelle Moody, who joined us to discuss mapping femicide in Australia, the media coverage of gender-based violence and its issues, and the impact of gendered violence on First Nations women and marginalised women in so-called Australia. Now, that conversation did cover some very distressing topics, including sexual and gender-based violence, violence against First Nations women and children, and racism. If you want support before or after listening to our show today, you can call 24-hour hotlines, including 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732, Lifeline on 131114, Suicide Callback Service on 1300-659-467, and for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, you can call these mob-only support lines, 13YARN on 139276, or Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. And for LGBTQ people, you can call QLife on 1-800-184-527, open from 3 p.m. till midnight. And for people between 18 and 25, you can also call Kids Helpline on 1-800-55-1800. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:48 in the morning.
Come down to Resident Frequency Community Album Launch on Friday, 13th of December from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Collingwood Underground Car Park.
Join us in celebration of our local talent. We have performers such as Eagle vs. Drone, Moonstazi, Jody Beaton, Basie Brown, Curly, Abraham, Vocal Boogie, Grimsim, Roy, Marley, Spike Speed, Rattles, Collingwood Kids and Kanani.
We are also featuring an art exhibition with Robin Rankin, Rowan Edwards, Collingwood College students, the Collingwood Neighbourhood House Friday Art Group and more in the Underground Car Park, entrance on Harmsworth Street.
Make sure to check out our local musicians on Bandcamp under Resident Frequencies.
Turn the music up loud.
Top kids. The rough kids bring a little light to the dark kids.
That's a missing link. Just take it day by day.
Resident Frequency Studio is
3CR supporter.
And we're back on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:50 in the morning. And earlier on in this show, we listened to the first part of a two-part interview with Genevieve Kaninda, Brussels-based policy and advocacy officer at the African Futures Lab, about the Brussels Court of Appeals landmark decision to recognize the Belgian state's responsibility in abducting and racially segregating biracial Métis children under its colonial rule of what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And just before, you heard Sherelle Moody, who joined us to discuss mapping femicide in so-called Australia, media coverage of gender-based violence, and the impact of gendered violence on First Nations women and children. And now we are going to part two of a talk given by Palestinian scholar and theorist Abdel Jawad Omar during the early October 2024 teach-in, The Left's Problem with Palestine, co-convened by the City University of New York, for Palestine, and Grad Center for Palestine. And in this talk, Omar presents a critical analysis of the Western left's reflexive condemnation of Palestinian resistance and the implications of this disavowal for the possibility of the West's genuine engagement with anti-colonial struggle. And you can watch the full talk and an extended discussion between Omar and Jody Dean via the link in our show notes. And also, if you head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast, you can listen to last week's episode where we played part one of this talk.
It's unsurprising, therefore, that instead of answering the call of a Palestinian liberation and with an affirmative belonging, many on the left are happy to find various intellectual and discursive answers that seek to contain the surge, to limit the impact of the flood, to break into this moment with critiques launched at the resistance, at those who suffered the brunt of a high-tech military machine. A discourse that seeks to limit and confine the radical politicization of new generations in the West, the various political possibilities that such a moment provides, including the ability of Palestine to reveal truth, not only about the conditions of settler colonialism in Palestine, but the network of economic, military, and ideological relations that sustains the hierarchies that we place on the value of human life in the world more broadly, whether it's on campuses in New York or in the industrial heartland of the U.S. and the constant flow of arms to Israel, or in the statements of politicians and the embrace of Prime Minister Netanyahu in Congress. Palestine can reveal much of the yoke in the empire if we are willing to observe and see. Let us consider then that while various forces, ideological, cultural, and historical, undoubtedly shaped the hesitant and timorous response to the prospect of Palestinian liberation on the left, they do not alone account for the full scope of this hesitation. To reduce this reluctance to a mere cynical gaze, one that casts the Palestinians as immature, irrational figures, an embodiment of the terrifying specter of Muslim anger, a subject willing to kill and die for a cause, would itself be an oversimplification. Nor can we attribute this hesitation solely to the echo of Orientalism, where the Palestinian is figured as a radically different other, rendered foreign and unknowable. At its core, the reluctance we witness is animated by something far deeper, an anxiety that goes beyond the familiar refrains. It is fundamental anxiety about the real possibility of liberation, not only for Palestinians, but also a deformation of the existing global order as such. The prospects of liberation introduces the specter of loss, a loss that threatens not only the ideological construct of empire, but the very infrastructure upon which a particular leftist intellectual apparatus relies. Here, the imperial juggernaut, with Israel as its critical knot in our region, sustains what we can call the deconstructive left, one that is preoccupied with endless analysis and critique of power. Yet the possibility of the unraveling of this imperial knot terrifies, for it signals the end of a discourse, a dismantling of the critical matrix that permits power to remain an object of an analysis rather than a structure to be undone. This anxiety is not reducible to guilt only over historical wrongs, nor to misplaced sense of culture or political affinity with Israel, nor does it stem merely from the desire to find redeeming qualities in Israel's settler colonial project. Rather, it's the fear that the collapse of Israel heralds the beginning of an unmaking, the unraveling of the empire itself. And it's this fear, this existential dread, that fuels the hesitation, the critiques, and the refusals. The loss of empire would signal the loss of the critical scaffolding upon which so much intellectual and political work has been built. An unbearable prospect for those who traffic in critique but feared the finality of a revolution. Thus, Palestine, the Palestinians emerge as a burden, a weight that is felt but must be cast off, a tragedy that elicits tears but must somehow made to disappear. It is paradoxical. It is a paradoxical presence, both the object of sorrow and the source of an unsettling political demand. Since for Palestine to be free, the world must truly and radically change. The tragedy of Palestine is one that invites grief, yet also produces an urgency on the left, a desire for its swift resolution or erasure of this very burdensome political demand, as if its very persistence disrupts the coherence of the broader intellectual order. In this sense, Palestine becomes more than a site of historical injustice. It becomes a discomforting reminder, a rupture in the imperial narrative and in the critiques of these imperial narratives, critical theory included. It's both inside and outside these intellectual discourses. And surprisingly, it threatens both. For those who engage with it only at a distance, it's a tragedy that cannot be fully absorbed, one that compels acknowledgement but resists resolution. It demands attention, but not in ways that allows for easy solidarities or symbol alignments from a left that is supposedly invested in change, liberation, and decolonization. Instead, it persists a reminder that the structures sustaining an empire are not invincible, and that their unraveling, though feared, remains also possible. Mahmoud Darwish expressed this Palestinian sense of feeling of burdensome, our own sense of feeling that others feel that we are a burden on their shoulders, an object that is not only attacked by the settler colonialism and its machinery, nor only by the empire and its spokespeople, but also attacked by those who are supposed to share in the struggle, who should be invested also in radical change. Drawing on the biblical prophet's story and the jealousy and the hatred of his brothers, Darwish writes a small poem where Prophet Joseph is not only betrayed by the wolves, meaning the empire and settler colonialism, but also by his own brothers. Darwish writes in his poem, "I am Joseph, O Father. O Father, my brothers do not love me nor want me among them. They assault me and throw stones and words at me. They want me to die so they can eulogize me. They closed the door of your home and left me outside. They expelled me from the field. They poisoned my vineyards. They destroyed my toys, O Father. When the gentle bees passed by and played with my hair, they became jealous and flamed up with rage against me and flamed up in rage against you. What did I ever do to them, O Father? Butterflies perched on my shoulders, stalks of weed swayed toward me, and birds rested in my palms. What did I do, O Father? And why me? You named me Joseph, and they threw me into the well and accused the wolf. The wolf is more merciful than my brothers. O Father, did I ever wrong anyone when I said, I saw 11 stars and the sun and the moon, I saw them prostrating before me? The question then arises, did the Palestinians wrong anyone when they dared to resist an externally imposed faith? Did they wrong the world by daring to propel the opening of a new political horizon, forcing a reckoning not only with the settler colonial state, but the world order as it stands? It seems that for many on the left, the answer is an unequivocal yes. The audacity to resist, to demand something beyond the present, is seen as an affront, as a disturbance to the carefully maintained equilibrium. And yet, while ending this war is an existential necessity for the Palestinian people, and hence the call for a ceasefire, it's equally true that the Palestinian political demand goes beyond merely ending the flow of bombs. It's not simply a call to cease hostilities, but a demand to end the conditions that make war inevitable. The Palestinian struggle insists not only on the cessation of violence, but on the transformation of the world itself, to bring about a reality where the necessity for war, oppression, and dispossession no longer exists. This is the deeper horizon of the Palestinian demand, one that refuses to be limited by the immediate, insisting on the possibility of a world otherwise. The left in the imperial core can observe us as a symptom, dissect Palestinian political formations, and analyze their ideologies, seeking to assess the revolutionary nature of the Palestinian struggle. But does not this very engagement betray a deeper impulse, one searching for a way to cast Palestine aside, to relegate us once more to the margins, to look upon us as a burden, as a source of political intellectual suffocation? There is perhaps in this critical distance a desire to avoid the uncomfortable proximity of our struggles, to push us back into the will of invisibility, where we become mere objects of study rather than subjects of transformation. Yet the real question, those that unsettle the empire, remain unasked. What does the Palestinian breakthrough of October 7th reveal about life within the empire itself? What truths emerge from this event? And more provocatively, does this breakthrough contain within it the potential to transform the world, not just for Palestinians, but in way that reach far beyond? Is there lurking in the background a fear of liberation on the left? Not only Palestinian liberation, but a liberation that threatens the very foundations of power, capitalism, imperialism, and the entrenched habits of critique that serves to sustain rather than to dismantle these systems? How then might this transformation be actualized? How might it ripple beyond the confines of the region, unsettling the structures of the settler colonial state and the global order, as the empire recalls, preserving itself through monstrousness? These are the questions suspended in silence that weighs heavier than words. The possibility of liberation trembles on the horizon, fragile and yet overwhelming, as the left debates Palestine in fragments, dissecting rights, formation, politics, and yet evading the essential. What forms of organizations, I mean leftist organization, could halt the empire's reflex, preventing it from redoubling its violence when this genocide is still continuing and the next genocide is only coming? What political strategies remain when the unthinkable occurs and when the Palestinian breach disrupts the order, unsettling not only the Arab region but rippling elsewhere too? Too many voices, it seems, withdraw or worse, settle into silence. They speak only at a distance, revealing how deeply this moment has exposed a potential, a chance for liberation, yet remains paralyzed by the fear of what such freedom might actually unleash. And there's a hesitancy, a retreat into comforts of critique, a gesture that both distances and refuses to transform. What is left is a politics of choking, a silencing that conceals itself behind condemnation of Palestinians and the Palestinians. Yet the point cannot rest there. Deconstruction alone falters if it fails to create. Demand is not only to unravel, but to rebuild, to imagine a world otherwise. It's no longer enough to critique or resist the world as it is. More so than ever, our hope, the Palestinian hope, must lie in a world remade. It's in this possibility of withstanding, of maintaining the capacity of to resist in Palestine, that we can serve a struggle. But also the struggle will be served by everybody else across the globe, including, most critically also, the left in the imperial core. I will end my talk here. Thank you.
And that was part two of a talk given by Palestinian scholar and theorist Abdel Jawad Omar during early October 2024 teach-in, The Left's Problem with Palestine, which was co-convened by CUNY for Palestine and the Grad Center for Palestine. And in that talk, Omar presented a critical analysis of the Western left's reflexive condemnation of Palestinian resistance and the implications of this disavowal for the possibility of the West's genuine engagement with anti-colonial struggle. And as a reminder, we played part one of that interview last week, so you can head back to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast to catch that and also to catch up on all of our previous shows if there's anything you missed or wanted to listen back to. And we will have a link to the full talk and extended discussion between Omar and Jody Dean in our show notes with today's podcast. And now we are joined by NARM-based artists Grace Zlabik and Dan Elborn, who are speaking with us about the upcoming debut exhibition of works by Grace's son, Elijah Kose, a collection of sculpture works produced in collaboration with Dan and titled Hands. Grace is an Austrian-Hungarian and Papua New Guinean woman from the Lavapia clan of Lese Oalai and Motuan clan Botai of Hanua Bada, and she is the founder and creative director of B Collective and B One, a grassroots international collective that forges artistic opportunity and pathways for underrepresented creatives. And Dan is a visual artist whose primary working material is clay, which he utilizes for long-form installation-based projects and sculptural series, building work on intersecting foundations of memory, time, labor, and materiality. And Hands is opening on Elijah's birthday, Sunday, the 15th of December, from 12 to 3 p.m. at Art House Gallery on Wurundjeri Country, 20 Old Warrandyte Road in Donvale. So good morning, Grace and Dan.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, morning. Thank you.
Yeah, it's really wonderful to be able to speak with you both in studio about Elijah's upcoming exhibition. And I know that this has been a bit of a secret process from you, Grace. So could you start off as Elijah's mum? Tell us a bit about his self-expression through art as you've seen it, which I know, again, has been a bit of a
limited
journey. Yeah. And what it's been like to see him grow into this creative process as a parent, but also as an artist yourself.
Well, Elijah, since he was really young, I've always encouraged him to be really creative. And so I've often witnessed his creative expressions through different ways of doing that, whether it's be, you know, really responsive to music or like, especially like the beats of music. He loves a bit like his mom, a bit of hip hop and R&B. So his expression through music has been a really big part of his life. It's also inherently really cultural for us to have like strong drums and beats and be responsive to that type of music. Ever since he was little, it's always been music in the house and singing from me and singing to him and him singing back to me, and also a lot of sensory play growing up. And so Elijah has cerebral palsy and is quadriplegic, and, you know, is what you would say is nonverbal, but is extremely expressive in other ways. And understands a lot, and is very perceptive of the world around him and energies. So it's been interesting to sort of see over the years how his forms of expression and his responses to environmental and social impact the ways that he responds to those things. So I think the choice of the word hands for the exhibition, Dan might be able to talk to this a little bit, but he uses his hands a lot to express himself. His right hand he uses more than his left hand. He's got more function in his right hand. But the sort of movements that he makes with his hands are really beautiful movements, and they're movements that you don't ordinarily see because his hands are formed in different ways, because, you know, the bones and the muscle around it and stuff haven't formed in the same way if someone's fully functional with their hands. And so, I think over the years witnessing his hands and the ways in which I love to just see them, how gentle they are and how soft they are and how expressive that they are as well, has been like a really beautiful thing to witness, but also the ways in which he wants to express himself using his hands. And so he's very tactile and sensory sort of, sensitive. so sometimes he doesn't like certain textures. And so the response to that is immediate, and it's usually through his hands. So Dan, maybe you could tell us, did the name come hands because he chose to say that?
Yeah, it was sort of a process of elimination, nearly, in narrowing down to that word. And how the sculptures took form was mainly through this interaction of his hands on material. As this really, like you say, tactile nature to clay, can record really, really fine gestures and also record really not aggressive, but just bodily movement. And the clay will retain that information. That'll expose itself in firings. If it's being moved one way, shifted back the other, it'll want to move backwards. And it was often his hands directly on material, either alone with tools sometimes, if he was in this sort of state of I don't want to get my hands dirty, man. Like, can you give me something? And just giving him, like, daggers and hammers and sticks, stuff that we would gather from our walks out in nature. And we sort of developed the show and that title. It's one of his favorite words, too. It comes out very, very clearly. There's a lot of association and expressiveness with those hands, and a lot of communication that happens with those hands, too. So it was about those hands on material, but also my hands in the studio, my hands on his, my hands cleaning his hands, massaging his hands. Some of the forms we decided on during hand massage at the end of the day, of just how they're interlocked and sort of moving around each other. And I was like, I think those things that you've been making and squishing could take a shape like this. He was like, yeah.
I mean, like, it sounds like a really beautiful way to sort of capture this gestural process and, like, this process of communication. I think gesture is something that is often, like, unless it's recorded, you know, in a visual medium, it can feel quite fleeting, but you're getting these moments of interaction and communication. And as you've mentioned as well, like, mutual, you know, safe touch and communication in the way that you're working together. And Dan, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the process of working with Elijah and in him creating these works.
It's been a really beautiful process, and one where it became secretive quite early. I sort of navigated that, not knowing how he would enter this zone of developing works over time. We've been sort of chipping away at them for 3 or 4 months, maybe. And the initial phase, I'm like, oh, I'm going to record some material, maybe get some nice photographs of Elijah's hands because they're so beautiful on the material. Anytime I whipped out the phone, even if I was, I propped it somewhere else and we were working away, he was cognizant of it and just like, dude, this is me and you. Like,
this is an invasion of my privacy.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not.
He's
cool
very
with
aware
this.
Of his boundaries.
Yeah, yeah, and so communicative around them. And just figured really early of being like, do you just want to keep this between us? Let's have a little like secret project. And he got really excited about that prospect, and also excited about this sort of reveal to Mum as an artist. And yeah, just your son, of like, there's going to be this grand unveiling of what we've made together. And he narrowed focus on exactly the same clay types that you are drawn to and you work with a lot. And I've watched Grace closely in creating works, and there's this really sort of delicate way that you interact with that material, as well as it being informed by like full body motion. And he approached it in exactly the same way, one of the crunchy, very survivable clay types that can really be pushed and prodded, as well as just sculpted if need be. So there are those options with it. And yeah, we just started making shapes. He started pressing on them, interested in certain tools over others, but it was primarily the hands on it in the right state of mind. And only really on these days when we have the spaciousness to set this stuff up, normally starting with a walk. On these sort of low-key days, he generally wants to get out into nature, and where Grace and Elijah live is close to the Mullum Creek, and we wander along the Mullum often, and it's very tranquil, very beautiful, lots of wildlife, lots of bird life, and lots of trees. And the shapes and the forms were really informed by that, because it was often right off the back of going on a nice walk together, like, you want to get into some clay. And we made a lot of decisions on those walks. Colors, textures. He went premium with everything. I came with many, many
the
options.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
It does not. It does not. Yeah, yeah. Every single option I gave him, he went for the highest and most, like, technically risky materials, which I love. it was very cool. There's a lot of gold going on.
Yeah, nice.
24 carat.
I mean,
24 like, carat gold only.
Exactly. Expect nothing less. Yeah. And I really like the that sort of juxtaposition in this process of, you know, wanting to be kind of secretive and being very intentional about when you do and don't work with the clay and deciding, you know, this sort of deliberative process and pacing of these works coming together, along with this really like bombastic, like very direct decision making around being like, I want it to be gold. I want it to be a surprise. Like I want, you know, I want this to be like a thing. So how did you, Grace, how did you find out about this? What was the process then of being like, all right, well, we're going to have a debut exhibition?
Well, how did I even find? I mean, Dan and Elijah, I knew that they were doing a little bit of art. I just didn't know what the extent was, or that, you know, being in a sensory sort of experience of going on their walks, they were actually, you know,
scheming
how to make these works and responsive to their to nature. Which it's funny to hear you talk about the whole process, because it's actually so similar to my process, which is that I have to be sort of intuitively led. I also need to also, like my spirit has to feel connected to nature before I can actually start to make. I haven't made anything for a while because, well, I've been traveling a lot to Papua New Guinea and back, but mainly because I haven't had time in nature. That allows me then to sort of like be able to create works from there. But it's funny that Elijah's done the same thing. Mm. And then my results of my works are also really highly premium. And I want to use gold in them and other things. So it's funny that he's also done that. And so, yeah, just hearing this has been like, I feel really proud of him. Yeah, I guess in many ways as a parent to him, I, you know, I want to give him the best that life has to offer and the experiences too. And, you know, some of those things are limited, like as to what you can do and what experiences he can have and who to trust and have around him to help him, you know, be able to be really expressive, because he also doesn't want to be around me all the time, you know, young man. And so, you know, having somebody like Dan in his life who, you know, Dan's our family, you know, and, you know, who I met at my former studio at Schoolhouse Studios, and then said, hey, do you need a job? and then now we're family, and to entrust him to also have built that relationship with Elijah, where Elijah can be safe and be fully expressive, is really something that I feel really grateful for, and that I know that Elijah really appreciates too. And they have their own little, like, you know, relationship, brohood, whatever, they're brothers. And so yeah, it's really touching to sort of have discovered that they've created this body of work, and now to discover that it has been on sensory experiences, and that nature has set the tone to be able to inspire these moments of making and creation. And like, I haven't seen any, so I can't actually wait to see on Sunday, or I might see it on Saturday actually. Otherwise I'll be a hot mess on Sunday, crying, bawling my eyes out. But yeah, so you know, it would be really nice to just see it on display. And And I know Elijah's really proud and also really excited to show me. I'm making a big deal out of it that it's a secret too. So he's loving that he's kept this secret from me. But yeah, so I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, and I guess before we talk about what's planned for the weekend, Dan, I was wondering if you wanted to share, I don't know, anything that has really stood out to you during this process of working together, if there's anything that you wanted to mention.
Yeah, the mind swims, there's so much. Yes, that raw process, it's been a really nice opportunity for me to share my primary passion with him and see him take to it similarly to you. Like this material is in his blood, in his bones, and that direct, the tactility initially, and then the decisiveness as it sort of got passed over to me in my studio, basically having all of these shapes, all of these things that Elijah had interacted with, forming ideas, but also chatting about like what we see when we look at the marks that he's made, and then assembling these things out of piles of stuff and sort of not putting any restrictions on it, but just, yeah, following his heart a bit, knowing what the material is capable of from my end with the state that it was in for us. And each work is, well, there's these vessels, these sort of sculptural vessel form things. I don't even really know how to describe
sculptures.
Them. Yeah, they're sculptures. Yeah, I'm excited to show you. I wanted to say more, but I really want to save it until they're in the space.
Well, we should say, though, that also any sales that actually are bought of his works will go towards an accessible vehicle for us.
Mm. Awesome. Well, actually, that leads then into the final question, which is, what's on for the weekend? How can people show up? And what is the process of purchasing an artwork?
Well, it's on Sunday, the 15th. We actually live at the house that the exhibition will be on. It happens to have this amazing sort of studio gallery that I often will exhibit and have community also do workshops there and opening it up for the public to enjoy. And so they can sort of expect that the exhibition will be on. It's also Elijah's birthday, so we're going to combine it with a Kai Kai feast, which is our traditional Papua New Guinean food. And I'll be doing a mumu, which is cooked in the ground food. And actually, I know this is weird that people open up their home to everybody, but everybody's invited to come along and enjoy in the offerings of Elijah, but also the celebration of what it is to be community and come together.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I wish I could make it, but I hope that a lot of people are able to come along and to take up the invitation to be a part of this, because from what you've shared in this conversation, it sounds like such a beautiful and intentional process that you've gone through, Dan, with Elijah, in actually shaping these works and deciding how Elijah wants his interactions with clay to be presented. And hopefully this will be the first of many to come.
I suspect so.
Yeah, but thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thanks so for having us.
Thanks.
And that was NARM-based artists Grace Lubbock and Dan Elborn, who joined us to talk about the upcoming debut exhibition of works by Grace's son, Elijah Jose, a collection of sculpture works that is produced in collaboration with Dan and titled Hands. And again, Hands opens on Elijah's birthday, Sunday the 15th of December, from 12 to 3 p.m. at Art House Gallery on Wurundjeri Country, 20 Old Warrandyte Road in Donvale. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:22 in the morning.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Hi!
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
And we are back on Thursday morning breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:25 in the morning. And I think we're going to take you very shortly through what we've had on for our show today. But we did want to let listeners know about a resistance and solidarity event that the Latin American Solidarity Network are putting on this Friday, the 13th of December. So if you bear with me for a moment, I'm going to bring those details up. So LASNET is running this event on Friday, the 13th. That is tomorrow. And the event is basically a fundraiser and a launch of a panel for First Nations resistance. It's a resistance and solidarity day for Kanaki, Abya-Yala, West Papua, and in so-called Australia. It's running from 2:30 p.m. till 11 p.m. at Black Spark, 126A Gladstone Avenue in Northcote. And it includes the launch of Radio Rada, which is a new media platform for sharing the stories of the resistance of Kanaka and other First Nations peoples, which is really, really exciting. This is a long-term project that has been worked on by folks, including Treaty Before Sports, the Treaty Before Sports campaign, where, you know, they've sent delegations to Kanaki, otherwise known as New Caledonia, and, you know, have been looking to report from the ground about the resistance to colonial occupation there. So, Leela, do you want to take us through what's on?
Yeah, and before we do that, I just quickly wanted to say that the vigil that Sherelle Moody mentioned will be happening on Saturday afternoon, December 14th, and it will be held at the Darling Gardens Rotunda in Clifton Hill from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. So you can go and honour the lives of women lost to gender-based violence in Victoria in 2024.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and we heard from Sherelle second today after Genevieve Caninda, and Sherelle joined us to discuss mapping femicide in so-called Australia, media coverage of gender-based violence, and the impact of gendered violence on First Nations women and children in particular.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Leela, we heard from Genevieve Caninda, Brussels-based policy and advocacy officer at the African Futures Lab, about the Brussels Court of Appeal's landmark decision earlier this month to recognise the Belgian state's responsibility in abducting and racially segregating biracial Métis children under its colonial rule of what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And today we heard the first part of that interview, and we're going to be listening to the second part next week.
And at 7:45, we heard part two of a talk given by Palestinian scholar and theorist Abdeljawad Omar during the early October 2024 teach-in, The Left's Problem with Palestine, co-convened by CUNY for Palestine and Grad Center for Palestine.
And finally, as you just heard, we were joined by NARM-based artists Grace Zlubick and Dan Elborn, who spoke with us about the upcoming debut exhibition of works by Grace's son, Elijah Kose, which is a collection of sculpture works produced in collaboration with Dan and titled Hands. And Hands opens on Elijah's birthday, Sunday the 15th of December, from 12 to 3 p.m. at Art House Gallery on Wurundjeri Country, 20 Old Warrandyte Road in Donvale. And it was such a beautiful conversation. I really hope that people can get along. And again, as Grace mentioned, any sales from Elijah's debut exhibition will be going towards getting them an accessible vehicle because, as Grace mentioned, Elijah has cerebral palsy and is quadriplegic and so does need to make sure that the family has an accessible vehicle to get around in. So please do go witness this incredible exhibition if you can, but also if you're in a position to, I would bid on those works. Anyway, we will catch you next week on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Bye. 3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.